This is Culturetopia, a look back at the week's best arts reporting from National Public Radio. I'm Linda Holmes, editor for NPR's entertainment and pop culture blog, Monkey See.
And I'm Alicia Montgomery, editor for NPR's Tell Me More.
Every week, we bring you the best cultural coverage from books and music to movies, television, and everything in between. And you can find links to all the stories we feature each week at npr.org/culturetopia. This week,
film critic Kenneth Turan weighs in on the new animated movie from director Hayao Miyazaki, a musical performance from the duo Sam and Ruby, and a new fantasy novel by Lev Grossman that is both an homage and a critique of the genre. But first,
guitar master Les Paul was best known for the electric guitar that bears his name. He was also a star in his own right as a musician and a pioneer in multi-track recording. Les Paul died last week of complications from pneumonia, 1 week after his 94th birthday. NPR's Tom Cole has this appreciation.
Les Paul was first and foremost a musician. His understanding of music, and especially the guitar, enabled him to dream about electrifying his instrument and recording it in layers. But he could play.
It's like a butterfly. It's just a lightning speed, but accurate and musical.
That's Jeff Beck, who's done some pretty fierce picking on his Les Paul, from a promotional CD released to celebrate his hero's 90th birthday.
I used to sit there and drool over how he did things, you know, just hitting the notes and letting three fingers peel off each of the strings. You could do amazing things with that. He had it all.
Les Paul started on the harmonica as a kid in his hometown, Waukesha, Wisconsin. He was born Lester William Paulfus, and he was a born entertainer. At the age of eight, he was making money, as he told me in 1996.
I would go out there and stand on a table, play at the Kiwanis Club, and make $5 singing cowboy songs, playing the harmonica. But my love was with Earl Hines and Coleman Hawkins.
Jazz players that he'd heard on the radio. Paul moved to Chicago and landed his own radio shows, playing country in the morning for one station and jazz at night for another.
When I heard Fats Waller, when I heard all these other great players, I knew that jazz is where I'd like to go. And you know, I dropped from $1,000 a week as a country singer down to $5 a week as a jazz player.
And that was Les Paul's conundrum and the arc of his career. Popular entertainer or musical innovator? Performer or tinkerer? His father was an auto mechanic, and some of that must have rubbed off. Paul traced it back even further.
Back to when I was in my crib and the train went by. And I says, when that train reaches that speed, my bay window is moving, Mom.
Les Paul delighted in telling stories of his discoveries. He took the diaphragm out of a telephone handset and wired it to his radio to make his voice come out of the speaker. He made his own disc cutter out of a Cadillac flywheel. In 1941, Paul constructed his famous log, as it was called, a 4x4 piece of lumber with strings and a pickup. While others were also experimenting, it was his first solid-body electric guitar. It didn't go over so well, so he continued working on it at the same time he was experimenting with something called sound on sound. Paul would record a guitar part onto a disc, then play that part back while playing a second part along with it, and record them both onto a second disc. He'd repeat the process over and over. The Les Paul sound was born. Les Paul got his first tape recorder from Bing Crosby and went to the Ampex Corporation, which had been working with the Navy on developing multiple-track data recording. Paul's musician's ears told him he could use it for something else.
Dear one, the world is waiting for the sunrise.
In 1949, Les Paul married singer Colleen Summer. He changed her name to Mary Ford, and in the home studio Les built, they created million-selling records. The radio show they did from home ran for 7 years. But there was a downside to success. Mary wanted more of a home life. Les was obsessed with music. They divorced. Then, paradoxically, Les retired from the business for 10 years. He made his comeback in 1974 with an old friend, Chet Atkins.
You see that red light, Chet? Don't get it confused. That means we're on
the
air.
The record they made together won Les Paul his first Grammy. A decade later, at the age of 69, Les Paul began performing regularly at a New York jazz club.
All my life, I was torn between being commercial and playing jazz.
It was a gig he kept almost until the end, playing well into his 90s when arthritis slowed the lightning fingers. But for him, the most important thing was connecting with an audience.
I never go to my dressing room. I go right off that stage and I go over and talk to him at the bar, at the tables. I think the most important thing to do is to get out there and do what you were put on this earth to do. And I know mine was to love the guitar and play it and to be with other people.
And that's how Les Paul should be remembered. Tom Cole, NPR News.
Well, from the sort of sad story of Les Paul's passing, we're going to talk about a pair of up-and-coming performers. The duo's name is Sam and Ruby. That's Sam Brooker and Ruby Amanfu. And they're not the likeliest of musical pairings. Sam grew up in the Midwest in Wisconsin, learning to play guitar and piano in high school bands and listening to everyone from James Taylor to George Clinton. Ruby was born in Ghana, raised in Nashville, but had her feet firmly planted in the church. She developed an R&B sound that caught on briefly in the UK, but never quite broke through here in the US. And yet when Ruby met Sam playing a tune at a Nashville club, she knew she had found her musical soulmate. Sam and Ruby joined Tell Me More's Michelle Martin in NPR Studio 4A to talk about and perform a few of their songs and tell us what brought them together.
Our relationship was like a slow evolution of friendship, and then the music didn't even come together until almost 3 years later, until we wrote a song together. We were just friends hanging out and just had mutual respect for each other. I'd come watch her shows and she'd come watch mine.
And it never occurred to you that the sound might work well together?
No. That's the thing about this project. We feel it was very natural. It just kind of came about when it was supposed to come about. We kind of feel out of control of this situation, actually. But that first song, we would sing it at each other's shows, and that's when we realized that this is pretty special. Our voices had this kind of magical blend that we heard.
Ruby, did you experience it the same way?
For me, it was very, very surprising. I knew that there was a connection in many ways, but I didn't know that we were going to be a duo. And so with his solo shows, I would come up and guest sing the harmonies or, you know, sing on the song. And people, it was the people around us who started saying, you guys together, there's something there. So for a couple of years, we heard, there's something there, there's something there.
What was the song?
The title track of our album,
okay.
The Here and the Now.
The Here and the Now.
Come sit with me on the porch where we last had a fight, and tell me it's gonna be alright. Look at me straight in the eye and make sure you don't lie, 'cause all we've got left is this night, and I'll let my guard come on down, 'cause I want your love around. I'm walking away from my past pride. The here and the now's what we'll make right if we get to see the morning light. Well, that's one more day we get to try. So let's give our love a chance to try.
And Linda, I was there for this taping, and it was really sort of a magical, I hate to use the word magical because it's such a cliche, but it felt like if you have a friend who has a guitar
and you know you're at a party with a bunch of other people who you feel really close to, and somebody just picks up the guitar and starts singing for everyone there. That's what it felt like. It felt like you were being brought into this sort of musical conversation between these two close friends. I mean, it was really a beautiful and touching performance.
Well, they often make magical music in Nashville and often make magical children's movies in Japan. The new film Ponyo is an animated movie that plays to parents as well as kids. It's from visionary Oscar-winning Japanese animator Hayao Miyazaki, who brought us Princess Mononoke and Spirited Away. Film critic Kenneth Turan has this review.
You'll be planning to see Ponyo twice before you finished seeing it once. Its special mixture of fantasy, adventure, and affection mark it unmistakably as the work of the visionary Japanese director Hayao Miyazaki. Miyazaki is the great genius of contemporary animation. The story he tells this time concerns a goldfish named Ponyo who desperately wants to be a little girl after she meets a small boy who loves her.
Mom, I think I'll call her Ponyo. Mm-hmm. She came to me. She might be magic. I saved her. She's my responsibility now.
Once Ponyo's on land, she proves to be a delightfully willful creature, determined to have her own way in all things. Though her magician father returns her to the ocean, she is not the type to give up on anything. She steals an elixir to help her become human, but that causes a storm to end all storms that jeopardizes everyone in the film. That supernatural tsunami represents the film's notion that magic haunts the edges of the everyday, mixing with the ordinary in ways we don't always take the time to notice. And underlying everything is Miyazaki's exceptional filmmaking imagination, his ability to bring us into other worlds, to stretch our minds without seeming to break a sweat. Ponyo is a sweet-natured film that emphasizes the joys of childhood friendships, and this English-language version has been given first-class treatment. E.T. screenwriter Melissa Matheson did the adaptation, and top-quality voice talent like Liam Neeson, Tina Fey, and Cate Blanchett have been hired. Ponyo won't remind you of anyone else's films. It offers up unforgettable images, like Ponyo running on the crests of waves. Images that use the logic of dreams to make the deepest possible connection to our emotions and to our souls.
And turning to another theme that draws a lot of kids and adults to movies, magic has been a part of one of the biggest movie franchises that's sort of crossed over from one generation to another, Harry Potter. And now there's a new book out that kind of touches on the Harry Potter mystique. What will Harry Potter do with the rest of his life? That is, after he defeats Voldemort and graduates from Hogwarts. Questions like that drove the thinking behind a new fantasy novel by Lev Grossman called The Magicians. It's a magical story in itself, and it's also a critique of the fantasy genre. Tom Vitale has our story.
On first glance, Lev Grossman's The Magicians looks very much like a Harry Potter story, only with slightly older characters and an American setting. The hero Quentin is a teenager from Brooklyn on his way to a Princeton admissions interview when he's whisked through a portal to an academy of magic called Breakbills. But Quentin differs from Harry Potter in that he reads fantasy novels, and he's enchanted to discover that the magic he's longed for all his life actually exists. Author Lev Grossman.
If I'd grown up the way Harry did, in an abusive, loveless step family, all I would have done was read fantasy. I would have been consumed by these just stories about escape and power. And I always wondered why Harry wasn't a fantasy reader.
Now 40 years old and the book critic for Time magazine, Grossman says when he was young, he was particularly taken with The Lord of the Rings by J.R.R. Tolkien and The Chronicles of Narnia by C.S. Lewis. In Grossman's novel, the hero is obsessed with a series of books about a magical land called Fillory, which is much like Narnia. But at Breakbills, Quentin discovers that in real magic, things don't always work out the way they do in fantasy novels.
Really, one of the coolest aspects of this book is that the students at Breakbills College act like real college students.
Elizabeth Hand reviewed The Magicians in the current issue of Fantasy and Science Fiction magazine. She says the novel is beautifully written, with well-drawn, believable characters.
I mean, these are kids or students who are having relationships with each other. Some of them are having, you know, romantic or sexual relationships. There are students who are gay as well as straight. Students occasionally making references to drugs. This is not your mother's Hogwarts.
If you could find them all, if you did destroy each Horcrux...
One destroys Voldemort.
How would you find them? They could be hidden anywhere, couldn't they?
True. But magic, especially dark magic...
In the Harry Potter books and their film adaptations, as in most fantasy stories, there is a powerful, malevolent being, a Voldemort or Sauron, who the hero fights in an epic battle. Lev Grossman says he purposely left the villain out of his fantasy novel.
Voldemort, and anyone like that in a fantasy novel, any big bad villain, has a kind of powerful organizing presence on the universe. You know who's good, you know who's evil, and you know what magic is for. It's for fighting evil. Well, when you take that away, suddenly the universe gets a whole lot more complicated. Suddenly it's all shades of gray, and it's not clear who belongs where, and it's not clear what magic is for.
In the end, the young magicians in Grossman's novel do use their magic to battle evil when they discover a portal to the magical realm of Fillory, which they thought only existed in their novels. With Fillory, Grossman says he wanted to reinterpret the Narnia of C.S. Lewis and the role of the lion god Aslan, also depicted in a film adaptation.
Aslan, we need your help.
I know, but understand, the future of Narnia rests on your courage.
I remember being very angry as a child and as an adult at Aslan. I always felt that here was a world that had a proper god in it, a god who you could see, who would come down and change the course of events. But he didn't do it very much. And he would often let battles go on and events really spin out of control, and people would die before Aslan would step in. Why would a god not help people in every possible way that he could?
So in The Magicians, Quentin and his colleagues confront the god of Fillory, a ram named Ember, demanding to know why he let his people suffer. The Magicians is Lev Grossman's third novel and his first fantasy book. Grossman says he used to care about being a literary novelist, but now all he cares about is telling a good story. For NPR News, I'm Tom Vitale in New York.
Well, that's a pretty ambitious project to reimagine the entire fantasy genre and start with the deconstruction of Narnia. And dare I say, speaking of magical kingdoms, our next story is about Woodstock. This past weekend marked the 40th anniversary of the Woodstock Music and Art Fair. Some of you were undoubtedly there. Others have just seen the iconic image shot from the stage, used in the poster for the original film Woodstock, of a crowd stretching to the horizon. And if you look carefully, you'll spot a young, slightly disgruntled-looking face under a black cowboy hat, sixth from the right. That's NPR music librarian Robert Goldstein. Here's what he remembers.
It had to have been one of the earliest examples of a viral event, long predating blast faxes, mass emails, web ads, the blogosphere, texting, and tweeting. Somehow, 40 years ago, word spread from person to person about a fabulous outdoor rock festival at a farm a few hours outside of New York City. I may have heard about it from my younger brother, who still has the three original $6 a day tickets he sent away for and received by mail. Yes, it surely was a different time. I still can recall most of the acts and music I heard at Woodstock. A much more vivid memory is of the enormous crowd's evolving awareness that it, and not the concert, had become the real event. Perhaps sparked by some psychopharmaceutical bonding process, hundreds of thousands coalesced into a single, well, semi-sentient organism. Inevitably, the crowd simply overwhelmed and upstaged most of the music. My own most indelible Woodstock memory is what current parlance terms a teachable moment. I call it the parable of the hot dogs. My circle of newfound friends and I were starving. Like so many others, we simply had arrived at Woodstock without much planning or preparation. That Saturday morning, rumors circulated of food kiosks located somewhere behind the gathered multitudes. Mud sucked at my knees as I trudged up the gentle hillside border of the festival site for nearly an hour. Wonder what was served at a typical American gathering for nearly 500,000 people? That's right, hot dogs. On reaching the vendor area, I waited in line for another hour and bought a dozen. I made the same muddy, laborious return trek, threading my way through masses of people protectively clutching that precious food. Somehow I found our prime location, center front of the stage. 3 hours to get a dozen hot dogs. The cardboard takeout box holding them disappeared into a tangle of grabbing hands. When the box returned to me, all that remained was a glistening red blob of ketchup. In my zeal to be the good guy, personifying the communal Woodstock spirit, to be the intrepid provider for my friends, I had waited until my heroic return so we all could eat together. While they, if by then their devolved reptilian brains could even muster a social concept, assumed that with so much time and trouble involved, of course I must have already eaten. What kind of fool wouldn't have? Oh, baby, have you now? So my oft-recounted, amusing, if cautionary, Woodstock fable imparts this lesson, that familiar message we all know from air travel. Always put on your own oxygen mask first, before assisting others. The official Woodstock message, the festival slogan, was 3 days of peace and music. That still sounds pretty cool, though to this day I try to avoid huge crowds and hot dogs.
And that's it for this week.
You can find links to all the stories we had today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Linda Holmes.
And I'm Alicia Montgomery. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia.